What makes farming work? A conversation about farmland access with Maine Farmland Trust. Editor's note by Liz Thompson. Across New England, a number of long-standing and effective conservation organizations are focused on protecting farmland and supporting a new generation of stewards in accessing conserved land. In this issue, we report on such initiatives in all states in the region, with in-depth stories from Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Vermont. This account from Maine is especially inspiring, describing innovative tools and out-of-the-box thinking to support new farmers as they seek affordable land to farm well into the future.
This is What Makes Farming Work, an interview with Stacy Brenner and Ellen Sabina from Maine Farmland Trust. Maine Farmland Trust, formed in 1999, supports land protection and conservation outcomes through the acquisition of easements, provides Maine farmers with unique and essential forms of technical assistance and community building, and offers policymakers at the local, state, and federal levels resources and guidance for creating a more agriculturally friendly future. With more farmers and more land in active production than any other New England state, combined with the lowest farmland prices in the region, Maine's agricultural landscape is often seen as a potential home for the expanded production and processing that would be necessary to build a resilient regional food system. Yet, despite the unique features of Maine's agricultural landscape, the same challenges of cost-prohibitive land, resource-strapped rural communities, and the ubiquity of cheap food from global supply chains combine to threaten the overall integrity of our local and regional food systems. I spoke with Maine Farmland Trust's President and CEO, Stacy Brenner, and Director of Farmer Engagement and Organizing, Ellen Sabina, to learn more about their approach to ensuring that land access and farmer success remain at the forefront of conservation and policy work. Ellen and Stacy, thanks for chatting with me today. I'm excited to talk about Maine Farmland Trust and your work in the farmland access sphere. From my observations of MFT's work over the past, it seems like the organization is trying to do a couple different really challenging things at the same time, one of which is protecting land and a natural resource from development, some of the most expensive conservation land that's out there. And the other is trying to support farmers in their never-ending quest to create a business that's sustainable and that's viable and that contributes to the food system. These are both pretty daunting projects, and I wonder if you could talk about how MFT sees those two projects intersecting, or why it's important to create an organization that does both of those things at the same time.
Alex, thanks for having us. We're thrilled to be here and share a little bit about our work. At Maine Farmland Trust, we are seeing farmland and protection and farmland access really not at all as separate from food system viability, but as foundational to it. And for us, we don't see a resilient regional food system without the land as a part of it. And it's not just any land, but land that is affordable for farmers, accessible for new farmers and farmers of color who've traditionally been boxed out of access, and also viable for the people that are stewarding it. And it is, as you say, a complex and daunting task. Land protection and viable farming are both challenging arenas on their own. But I think in Maine and in New England in general, we have an incredible opportunity. Maine is still a rural state. It has a strong agricultural history. Actually, I'm up at UMaine Orono today, and we walked through the first agricultural station building this morning, and it was kind of inspiring. It does now house a hotel, but... the campus hotel, but it's just exciting to see that history and know that there's still a lot of potential and capacity there. And MFT, our work is sort of about like knitting those threads together and keeping farmland and farming and ensuring that the people who are farming have what they need to thrive and keep their businesses viable and successful.
And could you share like how some of that knitting happens? What are ways that MFT's work are addressing both of those goals simultaneously?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that like drew me to working with MFT originally was that especially at that time, it seemed just really unique that a land trust was like also thinking about farm viability and really like understanding that like farmland isn't really a farm without farmers working on the land. And so over the years, like MFT has tried a variety of different things to try to both connect farmers to the land and to support them in establishing viable businesses, in like making transitions. And that's looked different. I think the other thing that I really appreciated about MFT is that like it's an organization that's like willing to change gears as needed. And like similar to farming too, it's like you try something, it doesn't really work, and then you like change it up and try something else. And so, yeah, we've gone through different iterations of like what farmland access work has looked like. For a long time, we've had the Maine FarmLink program, which right now is like a web tool, like a data online database for farmers, farm seekers, and landowners. To like see each other. At different points, we've done like sort of more active matchmaking. And I think that's something we're thinking about again. We've also just done a lot of like farm business support in different ways. That's included things like market development in the past, trying out a food hub to support local market development. These days, we've really honed in on like some business planning. Cohort model programs and one-on-one technical assistance to kind of meet farmers where they're at to achieve their goals. But yeah, it's looked different and it's like developing as the needs of farmers change as the world changes around us too.
I think changing gears and the ability to change gears is a valuable thing to pull out for some of the folks who might be reading this or listening to this. Could you just speak a little more to what the sort of bread and butter of this conservation and access work that MFT has called in the past has been? What are some of the programs or tools that have been effective in the past? And what are some things that you could see adding into the portfolio? I think you mentioned some of those projects like matchmaking and business planning being some really effective supports. Are there other things that you've tried in the past you're pivoting away from, or things that you're excited to sort of bring into the toolbox moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably like the biggest tool, like our primary tool that we've used over time for farmland access is like easements, agricultural conservation easements, and particularly purchased easements. So easements that we like fundraise for and I think that when it works best for farmland access is when there's like yeah, a farm that is like ready to transition and an identified like farmer who's ready to buy it, and the easement can like offset the cost to the incoming farmer. And when that has happened simultaneously, that like has created more affordable access for incoming farmers. But it doesn't always happen that way. And I think we also like over time have really recognized that like that still really relies on that incoming farmer having the ability to like finance a pretty significant like land purchase or have like you know a way to capitalize that and that excludes a lot of people so yeah as we move forward we like know that we need to kind of build off of that tool and figure out how to make that process more accessible to more people and create sort of like true affordability versus just like a reduced price. And so, yeah, we're thinking about different ways of doing that. I wouldn't say we've gotten there yet, though.
Can you share what some of those ideas are or different ways that are floating around?
Sure. So we have over the last few years started more actively using a tool called the option to purchase at agricultural value, which is an additional encumberment that gets placed with sometimes with the easement and sometimes retroactively. And we're starting to noodle around a little bit with could you use the OPAV all by itself without the easement? And the idea is that this would suppress the value at the time of the sale for the next sale after the one when the easement is placed on the farm. So an example would be there's a farm business, the farmer's retiring, the farmer owns the land and the business. They placed an easement about a decade ago. And now they're ready to sell, but they realize that because of attrition in the value of the business and the land, it's not quite affordable for an incoming farmer. And some of that we determine based on what kind of capital could and credit can a new farmer get access to through the Farm Service Agency's funding. And so, could we place an additional encumberment, the option to purchase at ag value, that would be the difference between the value of the property on the market with the easement versus the value of the property just solely for agricultural purposes. And so the difficulty with that model is in the quality of the appraisal to be able to determine what agricultural value is. And it gets further complex as development happens around farmland and things get skewed. And then when we're talking about agricultural value, it's tricky because we don't necessarily quantify the difference between grassland for grazing of livestock versus flat, laser level flat tillable acres for crops. And so that's kind of it's a muddy space that isn't an exact science, but that additional encumberment has offered opportunity for reduced value for new farmers coming in to purchase. We had one really, I think, nice example of a generational transfer from a grandfather to a grandson where the easement was already placed, but because the property was located in the area of really high development pressure outside of Portland, the grandson couldn't afford it and the grandfather needed the capital for retirement. So we placed an OPAV, paid the grandfather that amount, and that was enough for them to feel comfortable to retire. And the grandson now is running a farming operation in Cumberland. So that was an exciting example of us being able to add one more layer of a tool in and create a pathway. We have also started to think about what would it look like. One of the things we've noticed with farm length that is a deficit is we sort of it's like a dating app without like any, but it's almost like you need a dating counselor to like support that relationship development and unfolding. So we've started to think about what does it look like if MFT gets more involved in that lease process and handholds both the landowner and the tenant. And oftentimes, you know, the landowner has a lot of romance about what it's going to look like to have farming on their property and may not be super realistic about all that's going to be asked of them in terms of what they provide as the landlord. And then the new tenant, oftentimes young farmers are just so excited and ambitious and eager to get on the land that they may say yes to things that don't necessarily work for them long term and provide stability of tenure for them. And so trying to help broker that relationship more is a place we're thinking about getting more involved in. And even sort of future forward, like could we be a property management service and provide some kind of buffer between the landowner and the farmer lessee? So creative, what are all the creative ways we could engage with the landowners that we already know within our network of 345 easement protected properties is sort of the space we're going to sort of focus that energy.
I imagine Maine Farmland Trust is often maybe one of the first points of contact for aspiring farmers as they try to figure out where they're going to get started on their land. Have you seen any trends or changes in the kind of person who wants to get started farming in Maine over the last period of time? And could you just sort of describe maybe a typical or common profile of someone who's in that position of wanting to get started and reaching out for some land access support? If there is a typical profile, maybe there isn't.
Yeah, I would say there's probably not one mold, but generally we see a lot of entrepreneurial, mission-driven folks. They come to farming with a usually a pretty deep value around food justice and environmental stewardship, caring for their community. Many didn't grow up on farms. And they tend to come to it sort of trying to balance a job of some kind with also this entrepreneurial energy to build a business. And that, sort of that financial situation in that landscape is challenging. But they tend to be interested in diversified vegetable and small scale livestock, value added product type operations. Increasingly, they're interested in climate smart practices for their farms. But I'd say the common need for all of them is land security and, a need for land tenure in order secure land tenure in order to really, bring their business ideas to fruition. So that would be the common thread amongst all of them is just that really strong need for stable land tenure. It's hard for them to plan and to invest and to grow without it. And I'd say maybe like from a geographical perspective, folks, we see a lot of interest around southern and central Maine, but the prices for land sort of push people further out. So, but farmers are, like everybody else, they need childcare and they need housing and they need community and they want a market to sell their product into. So they don't want to be too far away from services, like the rest of us.
With that geographic question in mind, what's the state of farmland access programming or conservation conversations in northern Maine, where land is more affordable and certainly out there, but maybe has a few different barriers to access than it does in southern and central Maine?
Yeah, I feel like it. I mean, it kind of depends what part of northern Maine. But like, I think one thing we've sort of observed in Aroostook County is that like a lot of the cropland up there is still really valuable as cropland, and there are big growers up there who are, as land becomes available, are able to buy it. And so it is a little bit of a different like farm economy, farm landscape. But it does seem like there's more just like anecdotally from like talking with partners up there, through the pandemic, there has been like a push for people have moved up there to homestead or that kind of thing. And it's definitely like an area that we're wanting to be more, where we're wanting to be more involved and figure out the ways that our programs might adapt to like support the needs of that farm community up there.
I think some of the things we've talked about or looked at, both with Maine Farmland Trust and more broadly, is exploring some of these research projects or reports that map out what a regionally resilient food system looks like. One of them that we've explored a little bit in previous issues of From the Ground Up is the New England Feeding New England Report and how each state has adopted different goals to expand their local food consumption as a proportion of the total food purchased in their state. And a lot of these regional or New England-wide reports or analyses look at Maine as the breadbasket of New England and want to see both production and farmland, farmland and production expand in Maine as a way to solve some of the make progress towards some of the other goals in the region. I wonder if there are comments on that or thoughts about the sort of feasibility of expanding in Maine as a regional strategy, and if there's anything that has come across your radar that might tie into our ability to progress towards that sort of expanded regional capacity. Or is it being done in isolation?
I think in order to meet the bold targets that are set out in the New England Food Vision and then also in the Maine Won't Wait Climate Action Plan, we have to be big and bold in order to get there. We're going to need sustained public investment across the region in farming infrastructure, in land conservation, in land access. I think we need some regional coordination amongst our New England states. The biggest and most crucial thing in the development of this model is to center the farmers' voices in the model so that we can learn from them. What I've gathered over the years as a farmer myself is that increased production is not the limiting factor. Like, we can make the food. We can grow the food and we have the land available to do it, but we need a shift in the way that large grocery retailers approach regional food and prioritize it on the shelves in the store. So you should never go into a Maine grocery store and not be able to find like the top five produce items that are produced here that are stored year round, squash. Onions, potatoes, carrots, beets. Like, there should be no doubt that those items on the shelf in the grocery store and our large retailers should always be from Maine, but they're not. And like, sometimes you go into the Hannaford and you have a legitimately difficult time finding produce that is easy to produce here in our state. And that to me is super disheartening. And so, what are the levers from the public policy perspective that you can use to incentivize those retailers to buy our food? Because consumers need convenience. And so we do have to find ways to get them the product conveniently. And they're buying produce, but they don't have access to locally produced products. So some way we can shift that market space is crucial.
And to that point, I know MFT has, and other farm viability organizations around the region have spent a pretty significant amount of time and resources to support farmers in scaling up their operation. Some business planning, some implementation grants, those have all been pieces of MFT's sort of, offerings to farmers. So with that focus on supporting farms and scaling up and accessing bigger, potentially regional markets, are farmers ready? I guess you mentioned that, Stacy, that folks are able to grow, that there's capacity and support for them. Does it really feel like the marketing side is the missing link versus some of the other barriers towards expanding Maine producers' capacity to reach some of those larger currently inaccessible markets?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think if you if we could guarantee that when farmers scale up, that they're not going to have the deal that they've shaken hands with the buyer on pulled out from underneath them after a year or two, and their investment was going to be meaningful and worthwhile, and they could see the long view, we would be fine. But we get into pickles when we support the growth and development of an operation and help them implement a change to scale up, and then the market disappears out from underneath them. And then they have to spend time and energy redeveloping a new market in order to sell the product. We're not talking about unique products, we're talking about carrots. Like, it's just like a pretty basic item and a staple item in everybody's refrigerator that should be like part of your weekly diet. I mean, in some of this, I think we need the long view, and we should be all working towards creating a future where we're excited that our food is grown here, and the land is held, in trust for generations, and farming's viable and respected, and an equitable path for the farmer to be on. And there's like appropriate and realistic ways for succession and transition to happen, where the businesses stay profitable and viable, and markets stay intact during that succession and transition plan. And I think if we get this right, the landscape looks like vibrant rural communities and economies with thriving farmers and food grown by neighbors and a just economy. That feels like a worth fighting for.
I wonder if you could speak to the demand from different types of actors in this farmland access chain. Are landowners interested in working with MFT to protect their land or make it more available? Are you still having people, despite changes in climate, both environmentally and politically, are folks still looking to start farms? And where are some of the choke points, or where are there places where there's interest or lack of interest?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of this we're like interested to really like dig into as we kind of refocus a little bit differently on our farmland access work. And so kind of as Stacey alluded to, like, we have all these easements. We want to be doing some follow up with all those landowners to see like who among them is interested in leasing land to farmers, and how much land is that anyway? But we do have, I mean, landowners do reach out to us through FarmLink. I think there is interest in, there's interest, and then there's like, I think our role can be kind of better, like coaching and vetting to like make sure that the land that's sort of coming to FarmLink is well suited to agriculture, and also that those landowners are kind of ready to engage with farmers. I do think there's still interest in farming in Maine. Like, I think just anecdotally, it seems like people still think of Maine as a place to where there's land available, and it's like a pretty good place to come and start a farm with all the support services and just the overall sort of climate here. It feels like pretty intact in some way. And so I think I still feel like we have all the ingredients here to work with. And it's just a matter of like navigating those pinch points. And so I think definitely like through the pandemic, like the real estate market changes as there's just been more development pressure, more land use pressure of different types, and more people moving to rural areas. We need to figure out how to help make land less competitive, farmland less competitive, and more affordable. So that's a pinch point for sure. I think also just kind of for all the reasons that Stacey just outlined, like the economics of farming are still hard. And small farmers in Maine are playing in this sort of like global market space that doesn't really value like what they're doing. And so, yeah, whatever we can do in the policy arena or through the market to like change that I think it's going to be necessary for more folks to see farming as a viable, like, livelihood and career choice over the long term. Those are the, yeah, I feel like those are the two really big ones right now.
And I'll just add that I think landowners are perpetually and have always been, especially if in this farmland space, they've are always thinking about legacy, and they want to ensure that their land stays in farming, which is deeply heartening. But transferring that land equitably and affordably, especially to farmers who haven't had historically had access to it, is where we really need stronger systems and new tools that allow us to make that transfer happen. You talk about the political landscape, trying to help landowners realize that if the legacy of farming is realized, can we have a different looking farmer on that property, and are they ready for that? And can we move to that space and do it together? And we're seeing a lot of momentum and real pressure on the land development side, but we do have more awareness than ever about the urgency of the work, partly because of climate change, partly supply chain vulnerabilities from COVID, like Ellen mentioned, and just simply an evolving arc of awareness about the importance of local food. So those are all, I think, in our favor. But at the same time, the pressures in Southern Maine in particular are strong. We've got the pressure of solar development. We've got an aging landowner population. We've got challenges in the dairy sector. Infrastructure just keeps getting more and more expensive. And all of that prices out the next generation of farmers. So, how we figure out that puzzle and do it equitably is sort of at the crux of the work, I think.
Yeah, and doing it in a way that's like thoughtful, like takes like sort of the big picture and long view across the state and the region, but also is really informed by like farmers and the communities, like just thinking about how different the landscape is in like Southern Maine versus Northern Maine, or the different sort of ways that a multiple 100-acre dairy farm will have to transition into the future than like a smaller diversified veggie farm. Like there's just sort of these like very specific and localized challenges that we'll need to help navigate while we're also sort of holding the big picture, the regional picture.
Could you speak a little bit more about some of that competition or some of those other pressures on the land or on the viability of farm businesses? It may be tough if you're not really engaged in some of the land use and conservation arenas that you guys are pretty entrenched in, to put into context the sort of different threats towards the integrity of farmland. I know you mentioned real estate pricing and sort of post-COVID affordability pressures. Could you just sort of introduce what some of the other land use priorities or threats to farmland protection jump out as the most pressing? Is solar development a big enough issue to really drill in on that as a priority for good policymaking versus housing development or residential development? Or how do you sort of rank these threats, even just casually?
I think it would be somewhat anecdotal because I don't know that we have any specific data in the state that shows when we lose agricultural land, is it due to the business closing and being unviable in some way? Is it result, and it's just fallow, is it a result of that property is close to the grid and makes sense for a solar developer to approach that landowner? Is it because of housing? And you know, what's interesting is what we are most after as an organization at this point is well-drained cropland that we can, because that's the most interest we get from farmers soliciting opportunities for crop production. So that, you know, always makes the best development land because it drains well, and it always, and it, you know, it doesn't have a bunch of ledge, and it always makes the easiest spot to drill for posts for a solar field. So what we're looking for is like in, you know, exactly what these other developers are looking for. So from a public policy standpoint, things like trying to disincentivize the use of prime ag soils as a spot for solar is crucial. So if the slope is not if it has the proper slope and aspect and soil profile, you know, those are fields we want to disincentivize for solar and for housing. And you know, you can push housing into infill spaces first. But then you get into these sort of like broad conversations around what is the transportation network like and what is the housing. You know, we know we have a housing crisis, so you know, we're not in opposition as an organization to the development of housing because farmers and farm workers need housing as well. That's affordable, but we want to be mindful about what spaces it takes up and where it lands. So how do we incentivize smart land use planning as often as possible so that we're being mindful of protecting that ag resource? Because once you lose it, it's gone. And we just think there are maybe higher and better uses for that ag land for food production and agricultural production than for houses and solar panels. But to your question specifically about which one prompts the greatest threat, I think it depends on exactly where we are in the state, but I think that, you know, the housing piece and the solar piece are probably hand in hand.
Are there ways that MFT has tried to support the emergence of some of that more informed, integrated land use planning or policy making?
Yeah, we were involved in supporting a policy that passed through the state legislature that would create a impact fee and a mitigation fund so that if you're choosing to put your solar development on prime ag soils, there would be an additional cost for that. And then that money could be used for conservation land protection efforts in other parts of the state to try to encourage kind of a one for one in terms of if you're going to take that prime ag soil out of production, we need to protect that asset in another place in the state. So we worked hard on that policy, went through rulemaking. Both the DACF and the DEP had rulemaking for that bill. The DACF rulemaking moved through the legislature, and the DEP rulemaking is making its way through now, so we'll see what the outcome is. So we're not quite there yet. It's not been implemented, but it is in chaptered law. So we'll see how it unfolds next steps. And then, of course, the you know the rubber always hits the road when you start to evaluate the implementation of whatever that policy is to see how it works. But needless to say, the solar developers aren't pleased with what we've done as a policy approach. So. Let's see.
So when you see a press release with MFT celebrating the protection of another farm with generally a very happy and relieved landowner and new farmer in the picture, it's a real success story to feel good about. How has it been a challenge, or has it been easy to bring your member and donor community into some of those other less visually rewarding elements of your work? I know that you know, municipal policy may or may not be something that drives a bunch of gifts to MFT, but I'm curious how the sort of transition in model, the expansion of focus into both policy and access pathways, how's that resonated with folks in your community?
mean, I think people people love the access story, like you're saying, like the end of the story. So I feel like, and that's kind of, it's something that like people sort of expect from us already, or like understand that we're involved with. And so I think as we like grow and deepen that work, like I think we'll be able to bring people along with that and also sort of share the the like how the barriers have like grown, and so how there's this like need for new tools. But yeah, it is, I would say like the I think as we've developed like a lot of our sort of like farmer support programs, this is like sort of long-term work in a lot of ways, and a lot of it is sort of under the radar. It's not like this like very tidy package. And so it is harder to like tell the story because it's not like this nice little arc, or it might be after 10 years or something like that. I think it's great that like MFT has been a storytelling organization for so long. Like I think we've at least brought our membership along with like kind of what you guys are doing in the from the ground up, like trying to like kind of pull back the veil a little bit and like show the messiness and the complexity so that like people understand, our members understand that like some of this stuff is not tidy and it's going to take a while, and yet is worth the investment. But yeah, it is a different kind of story.
Yeah, and we've really leaned in to try to tell the story about how viable farms really are our most protected farms, because they're the ones that are doing well and are the least likely to have a succession or transition need. And you know, viable equals profitable, and so it just takes that jeopardy concern of losing that land to agriculture out of the equation. So we've leaned in to try to tell that story as often and as effectively as possible. And so when we do have an opportunity to have an audience with our members or donors, like through the Maine Farms Journal, is one example, through our annual meeting, you know, we really try to highlight the viability work. And then, sort of second to the viability work, which is like a newer body of work for the organization around climate, in many ways, the climate work is actually viability work, right? Because, you know, the more durable your farm is to changing weather, changing climate, the more capacity you're going to have to be efficient through those transitions if you're able to put, practices in place that help you weather those storms. So, talking about the way we've been plugging in our climate work and how it dovetails to the business viability work is important. And then anytime we can tell allow farmers to tell their own story about how services have worked, and most importantly, what we try to do is help them tell the story of how stacking services and funding throughout the state and the feds, like what USDA funding, what state of Maine funding, what funding from MFT supports along the way, how does that whole package of a community of agricultural service providers support a farm's business capacity? And so trying to help members and donors understand that, if we waved a magic wand and we preserved all the farmland in Maine, like we couldn't stop there. It wouldn't be enough, because we need to make sure that the stewards of that land have everything they need to be successful. So, like, what does the wraparound look like to hold them and help them when they tell us, hey, I'm struggling with markets, I'm struggling with QuickBooks, you know, whatever the thing is I'm struggling with, that we can try to figure out how to best support them through that struggle. You know, that's the work we're here for the long haul. And so even if we did protect every last tillable acre in the state, we're not done, because they, you know, when you're farming, it's nice to have professional support for the things that come up that are problematic.
Now I'm going to ask an impossible question about that sort of complete package of support. I think, we're still learning about how the changes in federal policy and priorities are impacting land protection and conservation. But I think it's probably safe to assume that the USDA's capacity to support both land protection and farm viability investments to the same level is in flux, to be generous. How do you deal with that? And are there things that feel like valuable alternative pathways or alternative projects or arguments for additional public support or philanthropic support that could fill that gap that you see as maybe worthy of calling out in this moment?
Alex, you mentioned our municipal policy work, and I think leaning into the very local aspect of our work whenever possible. So, speaking with town managers, with towns that are moving through their comprehensive planning and trying to affect land use policy and ordinances at the town level that make them farm friendly, and could help us tackle some of that affordability and access to land issue that we are going to struggle with without federal support. That could be helpful and worth investing in. And like you said, it's not quite as sexy as like a land protection transaction deal going through and the Forever Farm sign and the the farmers transitioning and in that story. It might be a less expensive alternative to land protection that could yield similar results in terms of affordability and access. I do think that we have been quite successful over the last, I'd say, decade or so, having the USDA acknowledge and respect and support the scale of agriculture that happens in central southern and all the way through Maine, actually, even Aroostook County. So having those supports from the USDA for the scale of agriculture that happens in Maine over the last few years has really been exciting. We've been able to see lots of different pilot projects emerge that have been successful. And so losing that support would certainly be devastating. I still hold out optimism that it's not all lost, but if we were to see a future where the funding for the scale of agriculture in Maine that the USDA hasn't been investing gets pulled and gets redirected towards large-scale commodity producers to write off tariffs, I would be pretty disappointed.
I know, so MFT is a statewide organization in a big state. I have to have relationships that cover a lot of ground. I think in some of the other New England states, there's less of a, well, the number of and geographic diversity of some small conservation-oriented land trusts may be a little greater. And so I wonder if you could just if any examples of successful ways that Maine Farmland Trust has collaborated with local partners to identify and protect or support a farm transition process come to mind.
Yeah, having trouble coming up with a good recent example, but I do think that like MFT is like well sort of known and considered throughout the state, like among our land trust partners, among all of our partners, as like the organization that can support farmland protection. And that's like pretty remarkable. I think a lot of a lot of our other New England and Northeast counterparts have much more like public funding support and for farmland protection. And so it's pretty remarkable that like MFT has been the entity basically protecting farmland and throughout the state. And I think, we do work with partners all the time. Like land trust partners will reach out when someone comes to them in their community with a farm property. And often we decide to get involved in that project. And then likewise, there are a number of projects that we've done where we've kind of led the protection aspect of the project and then turn over the long-term stewardship to the local land trust. And I think that that's really important to just have that kind of like, I mean, that's pretty ideal really, is to have like some like a local connection, because it is such a diverse state, in terms of like the all the pockets, the geographical pockets that are pretty distinct and have their own networks and communities. And I think that's like, as we think about doing our work, farmland access work, farm viability work, like it's always stronger when we are able to do it with those like community partners.
I think we're always stronger when we're collaborating as a society, I believe. And so that's rings true in the land conservation world as well. And I would always encourage local land trusts to lean into the opportunity to protect farmland whenever possible. It is like something I think every there's, you know, we want to protect the last farm in every town and the best farm in every town. It's sort of like the thing that sometimes comes up the table when we're talking about what opportunities we're considering. But having the local land trust participate in that effort, it just further draws the community to the project. As the farm builds itself up as a business, it creates a ready market for that farmer, a support base for their product and the work they're doing. If they were to run into trouble and need support at a town meeting, that group up underneath them from the community work of raising the capital to protect the land is right there with them to have those conversations at the town level. And you know, we're always thinking, you know, we know the group of donors and supporters from the philanthropic perspective that are going to support local land trust work versus a statewide agricultural land trust, it's pretty similar. And so to get into a space of fear or greed that if you introduce donors from one organization to another, that you may end up minimizing the amount they'll contribute to you. I actually think the opposite is true. I think donors and members are pleased when there's not duplicative efforts and we're combining forces and collaborating. Because at the end of the day, what we all want is the same thing. We want the land to be protected and to stay in agriculture and be viable as a business. And so if that result can be realized through the collaboration, which I believe it can, and we have a number of successful projects we could point to, it just makes the, I think, a richer, more vibrant local food system.
Recognizing that some of the access and protection challenges aren't unique to Maine, even though Maine does have some unique features around the region. If folks are interested in learning more about how MFT is considering some of the challenges and how the organization's strategy towards supporting a sustainable and resilient food sector are evolving, how could folks learn more about that, or how could they engage in the discussion and benefit from some of your reflections and thinking? And you can say,
Yeah, I mean, I would love to, like, I feel like we have some ideas, we have some like reflections and thinking, and we're also excited to like learn from other people too. And so I think especially in this kind of like moment of expanding our farmland access work a little bit more, yeah, we're really excited to connect with other folks who are thinking about this stuff throughout the region and the country, really. So people can just reach out. We haven't think we've like published anything. Like we're not at that kind of point. There's nothing on the website really. But there is a lot of thinking and conversation happening in the organization. And definitely excited to, yeah, tap into other brains that are thinking about this. It is really remarkable to me. I was just listening to, have you guys read that book by Rick Rubin about like creative practice? No. Okay. Sort of a tangent, but
I've read.
I just, the idea about like how creative ideas are just kind of like out there, or like, they don't come from just like one person. You kind of like tap into them in some way. And just having conversations with a couple people so far around the country around like farmland access work, it's really cool to see that people are thinking about similar things in similar ways with slightly different like, considerations. But yeah, it just is sort of really heartening to know that like we're all kind of like grappling with this together and trying to find ways forward, and that nobody's figured it out yet either, in like a perfect way. So the more that we can tap into that sort of like collective thinking and consciousness around this, these really complex issues, I think the better.
We do have our journal annually that I think sometimes dives into a little bit more of a long format thinking space for some of the work we're doing. We have to really look at this work as like a full ecosystem, long game, land access, business viability, racial equity in farming, climate resilience, market development. They're all part of the same story. Of what we're trying to work on. And MFT, we're trying to balance all of those needs with integrity. We can't do it alone. So we need collaborators and we need to build trust with partners and with farmers and with land seekers and with consumers and members. And so I think we just keep asking questions and we keep asking what makes farming work here in Maine. What makes farming work long term? How do we move our resources, land, dollars, relationships toward that future that we collectively want to see, where there's a vibrant rural economy that has agriculture at its root and stores full of Maine-produced food?
It's a great place to wrap it up. So, thanks again to Alan Sabina and Stacy Brenner from Maine Farmland Trust. If you're interested, you can see some links to some of the resources that were mentioned during this discussion and a few photos of some of the great farmland access projects that MFT has supported over the years, all on the printed version of this article at fromthegroundupne.org. Thanks again, Alan and Stacy.